Letter to Claudia Bush, July 13, 1974. 416. Dear Claudia, inasmuch as I've delighted you so far with my unusual, to say the least, trip into big dreams of big books, then I might as well go all the way. Now, as I've mentioned, among other things I've dreamed about, a big blue book whose title ends in the word grove, and before this is a word starting with a B, which could be blooming or budding or something. A book in which everything there is. The Sibyl, who knows and sees everything, the deeds of men, especially. The Cyclops, in the same dream as above, contributing the seeing eye. A friend called Paul, holding up galley proofs for me to read, which I am told consist of a book of prophecies, and in which I find a passage about myself. Again, a huge manuscript of printed pages, but not quite a true bound book in our terms, yet enormous. The word syntonic, which I am told to be, and which when I wake up I believe to be, a neologism, but when I finally look up and find to be a real word, Greek meaning self-harmony, etc., in harmony with, etc., a key term in Pythagorean thought, also Roman. Well, Claudia, let's take the above five in terms of what I found in my funky reference books. Now, ESP has been described as when you somehow acquire knowledge you shouldn't have or have no way of having, whether it's about the future or what's in the next room or in another person's mind, etc., or in the past. Since I wrote you earlier today, I decided to look up Virgil's Aeneid, because in the short paragraph which I quoted to you about the Cumaean Sibyl, it's in that book where she's mentioned. Okay, here is what I found. In Book 3 of the Aeneid, there's a long description of the Cyclops. In a later book, Aeneas meets Queen Dido. Then the Sibyl takes him through mystic passages of the blissful groves, where those who led good lives bask in green valleys and endless joys. Will Durant's Caesar and Christ, page 241. Note, blissful groves. So we have here 1. The Cyclops, 2. The Sibyl, and 3. The blissful groves, which is indubitably what I saw in my dream, and also the fact that the Sibyl has a lot of books of prophecies which she burned one by one, as in my dream of the singed book held up to me to read, each page rimmed with singed black, as if the book had gone through a fire, but had been rescued. Now, Claudia, I never knew any of these things, and it certainly is odd how much are from a single strand of myth from Roman and Greek times, right down to specific Greek words, such as syntonos, or however it's spelled in Greek. Also, I dreamed the word ulna one time, as I mentioned in the form of sedasa ulna. Well, I looked it up, and it is Latin for elbow. But also, it can stand for a measure of length, and the citation in my complete Latin dictionary for its use is Virgil's Aeneid, Book 3. The word ulna appears there as used by Virgil in that fashion, and although other citations follow, its appearance in that book would seem to be the initial use of it that has survived, and the best known to scholars. So my dreams seem to refer again and again to a specific paradigm, and that paradigm is being explicated with each dream until now I can't avoid seeing what the paradigm is, or was 2,000 years ago. So this could be placed under the rubric ESP, or more accurately, ESP knowledge. What the dreams I've had from mid-March to now, which is to say scores and scores of them, mean is that this is prophetic knowledge, which is to say, I can take what comes and has already come as accurate prophecy. Once this is established, the so to speak credentials, then it can and has gone on to the knowledge itself, such as last night about the assassinations in this country, which the Sibyl said included Jim Pike, Bishop Pike, that is, who knew Bobby Kennedy and Dr. King, and who is my friend. I knew Jim very well. The Sybil said that the three burglaries of my house between November 1971 and March 1972, in which all my papers were taken finally by the time it was over, had to do with the belief or fear that I had material Jim Pike had given me before his death. I had said he had done so in the foreword of my 1969 novel, A Maze of Death. This was the purpose of the three burglaries of my files. They had reason to think so. I had said so in A Maze of Death. I always wondered why my papers were taken. I could never figure it out, and the police said they were baffled too. In April of this year, when I was in the hospital for high blood pressure, caused really by these dreams, I met a lawyer and told him at length about the hits on my house. His theory, after careful thought, was that it was most likely that they were after papers concerning Jim Pike, religious material Jim had given me or told me before his death. In at least one of my dreams, Claudia, I was Jim Pike. I know that because I saw my mother, and it was Jim's, Mrs. Chambers, who I once met. Also, Jim was a Latin scholar, his specialty, in fact, his joy in life. I am freaked when you consider his book, The Other Side, about the dead coming through to the living. He gave credit to me in its foreword for research work. Love, Phil. Letter to Claudia Bush, July 16, 1974. 434. Dear Claudia, herewith you will find a copy I made for you. I did the whole damn thing word by word on my own typewriter of a short piece I wrote which I think a lot of. I'm sending it to you because first I do think it has worth, and it's a present to you from me, what I have best to give. I was going to put it on the market, but never mind. There is, however, a second reason. I wrote the short piece with no thought to any formal system of thought, past or present. It is just what I experienced and believed. The next day, when I read it, I saw instantly that it was unquestionably Hindu doctrine. There is the path, dharma. There is the delusion that hangs over reality, maya. And there is the light of God shining below maya, brahman. But later on, I realized that even more was involved. The clear concept of the liar. When I looked through my reference books, I came across it and recognized it at once when I turned to a passage about Zoroastrianism. The God of light versus the master of the lie. There it was. I could not recall ever having known that before. Perhaps I did, but it was no longer a conscious part of me. Needless to say, honesty was valued by the Persians as the first virtue after piety, which was needed to justify honesty, evidently, since in those days everything had to be assigned to a supernatural cause to make it stick. They believed other good things as revealed to them by Zoroaster, as revealed to him by Ahura Mazda, by way of the Avesta, such as it being a sin to feed unfit food to an animal such as a dog. The greatest thing in the Persian system, of course, was its affirmation of life, the value of life, the joy of life, the justice possible in this world and not the next, the value of trying. It put down passivity, resignation, despair, and I'm glad to say, once released from the power of the lie, I saw passivity, resignation, and despair as intended byproducts of the lie. And any system of thought or religion which taught those as virtues, Christianity included, as a manifestation of the lie. Well, there I went and said it. Any system which says, this is a rotten world, wait for the next, give up, do nothing, succumb. That may be the basic lie, and if we participate in believing it and acting, or rather not acting on it, we involve ourselves in the lie and suffer dreadfully, which only reinforces that particular lie. I imagine that if sweet Jesus is listening to me, he is becoming very angry now. But if he follows his own philosophy, he will fold his hands, look tragically toward heaven, and do nothing. Meanwhile, I am trying to bring back an affirmative view of life as was stamped out furiously whenever it appeared in history. And all I can hope is that I won't get caught. Well, I will be, but hopefully not too soon. It's a nice world, and I'd like to stick around and enjoy it for a long time. But I got to say what I think is so, right? Whatever the consequences. Love, Phil. July 8, 1974. The first day of the constitutional crisis. Enclosure. Letter to Claudia Bush, July 16, 1974. But the state of things is so dreary here in the U.S. They say the elderly and poor are eating canned dog food now to stay alive, and the McDonald's hamburgers are made from cow's eyes. The radio also says that today, when Charles Colson, the president's former counsel, went into jail, he still wore his Richard M. Nixon tie clasp. California dreaming is becoming a reality, is a line from a Mama's and the Papa's song of a few years ago. But what a dreadful, surreal reality it is, fog-like and dangerous, with the subtle and terrible manifestations of evil rising up like rocks in the gloom. I wish I was somewhere else. Disneyland, maybe? The last sane place here? Forever to take Mr. Toad's wild ride and never get off? Note. When he wrote this sentence, Dick sat less than 10 miles away from Disneyland, a geographic synchronicity that reminds us how regional a writer Dick was. Unlike most California writers, however, he bridged the two hemispheres of the bipolar Golden State. Before moving to the tacky conservative sprawl of Orange County, Dick lived for decades in the Bay Area, absorbing the lefty bohemia of Berkeley and Marin County. In 1973, he wrote Stanislaw Lem, "There is no culture here in California, only trash." But as Dick's own work proves, trash can achieve a visionary intensity, even a kind of escape velocity. After all, California was also the petri dish of our digital age, spawning the internet, biotechnology, the personal computer, and geosynchronous satellite communication. And California has long encouraged the restless, eclectic, and sometimes wacky search for spiritual authenticity that drives the exegesis. There is no more Dickian a Mecca than Disneyland. Indeed, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride offers a model for the entangled plots of a Phil Dick novel, a fantastic contraption that careens through a variety of trapdoors and false fronts and deposits you in a kind of surreal hell. But then the doors open once again, and you face the blank blue sky. Eric Davis, ED. End note. The landscape is deformed out of recognition by the lie. Its gloom is everywhere, and we encounter nothing we recognize, only familiar things without the possibility of accurate identification. There are only shocks until we grow numb, are paralyzed, and die. When I suddenly stopped believing in the lie, I did not begin to think differently. I saw differently, as if something was gone from the world or gone from between me and the world which had always been there, like a scrambling device that had been removed, deliberate scrambling. All, suddenly, was clear language. God seemed to seek me out and express things through things and what took place. Everywhere I saw signs along a path marking his presence. Any lying language creates at once in a single stroke a pseudo-reality, contaminating reality, until the lie is undone. As soon as one lies, one becomes separated from reality. One has introduced the falsification oneself. There is one thing no one can force you to do, to lie. One only lies for one's advantage. It is based on an inner decision invisible to the world. No one ever says to you, "Lie to me." The enemy says, "You will do and believe certain things." It is your own decision to falsify in the face of his coercion. I am not sure this is what the enemy wants, or anyway, the usual enemy. Only a greater enemy, so to speak, would want that, one with greater objectives and a clearer idea of what the ultimate purpose of all motion is. Sometimes in the past, about 3 months ago, I must have become aware for the first time in my life that the cause of my misery was the lie, and that the enemy, the real enemy, was a liar. I remember somewhere along the line saying loudly, "He is a liar, he is a liar," and feeling it to be very important, that discovery. I forget, or rather, I guess it does not matter, what specific lie by which person made it all change. There was a person. There was a lie. A week after I realized that with no possibility of evading it, everything altered radically for me, and the world began to talk, in a true language of signs, silently. The lie had slipped away. The lie deals with talk, written or spoken. Now it's gone. Something else shines forth at last. I see the cat watching at night for hours. He has seen it all his life. It is the only language he knows. I think a lot about my early childhood and remember events in it vividly, which I guess is a sure sign of senility. Also, events that took place within the past 10 years seem dim and not really a part of me. Their sadness is gone, used up. I encounter new, fresh sadness in my remote past, like stars that burst into life when I noticed them. When I pass on, they again are forgotten. Usually, however, senility is a gradual process. Mine came on abruptly when I noticed the cat trying to discern what was causing me pain. I had stomach flu. And then, what he could do to help me. He finally got up on my abdomen, transversely, and purred. It helped. But then when he jumped down, the pain returned, whereupon the cat got up again. He lay on me for hours, purring. And finally, the disturbed rhythm of my stomach began to match the pace of his purrs, which made me feel much better. Also, the sight of his jowly face gazing down at me with concern, his keen interest in me, his friend, that changed me. To suddenly open my eyes, I had been lying for an hour on the couch, and see his concerned, large, furry face, his attention silently fixed on me. It was not an illusion, or, put another way, his field of energy, his strength, was at that moment greater than mine, small as he was, since mine had dimmed from the flu and his was as always. Perhaps his soul was at that unusual moment, that critical moment, stronger than mine. It is not usual for a small animal's soul to be larger than a man's. He warned me, and I recovered, and he went his way. But I changed. It is an odd senility to be comforted and healed by a small animal who then goes on, as always, leaving you different. I think of senility as a loss of contact, a drop in perception, of the actual reality around one. But this was true and in the present, not a memory. The constitutional guarantees of our country have been suspended for some time now, and an assault has begun on the checks and balances structure of the government. The Republic is in peril. The Republic has been in peril for several years, and is now cut away almost to a shadow of itself, barely functioning. I think they are carving it up in their minds, deciding who sits where forever and ever now. In the face of this, no one notices that virtually everything we believed in is dead. This is because the people who would have pointed this out are dead, mysteriously killed. It's best not to talk about this. I've tried to list the safe things to talk about, but so far I can't find any. I'm trying to learn what the lie is or what the lies are, but I can't discern that anymore. Perhaps I sense the lie is gone from the world because evil is so strong now that it can step forth as it is without deception. The masks are off. But nevertheless, something shines in the dark ahead that is alive and makes no sound. We saw it once before, but that was a long time ago. Or maybe our first ancestors did. Or we did as small children. It spoke to us and directed and educated us then. Now perhaps it does so again. It sought us out. in the climax of peril. There was no way we could find it. We had to wait for it to come to us. Its sense of timing is perfect. But most important, it knows everything. It can make no mistakes. It must be back for a reason.